Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday afternoon. Why has, it's not true for all television, but our guest this hour asked a question that I really never had thought of before, but I'm so glad it's done this because it opens up all kinds of television. Unfortunately for me, some binge watching, which I have never done before, and now I do it fairly often, at least the past few months. Maybe just in winter, right? Why has American TV suddenly embraced complex storytelling in recent years? Our guest this hour says that we need to consider major shifts in the TV industry, new forms of television technology, and the growth of active, engaged viewing communities. Our guest is the author of Complex TV, The Poetics of Contemporary Television Storytelling. Professor Jason Mattel is a professor of film and media culture and American studies at Middlebury College. He's also the author of Genre and Television, From Cop Shows to Cartoons and American Culture, Television and American Culture, and co-editor of How to Watch Television. We'll be welcoming phone calls. There are so many of these shows now that I've only seen a few of them, but we're looking at serialization and complex storylines in some that are on TV, you know, your regular network shows. The Good Wife, he mentions. Certainly there are others, and there are a lot of these programs on Netflix and on FX. So we're going to be talking about many of them, and why all of a sudden, you know, The Americans, Game of Thrones, Walking Dead, the list goes on and on. There are so many of them, and they're complex, and in some ways this is a good thing, right? We're going to welcome your phone calls. We've had a lot of messages on Facebook on this, and we certainly welcome you to join us on air. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And we should also tell you that our guest is a graduate of UW-Madison, so that's a good thing, because I'm going to start with basketball, because we have to move that in. Of course, we're going to see a very entertaining and incredibly complex basketball game tonight with a Wisconsin victory, don't you think?
I have no expertise on basketball, but I will certainly say that the television event will be satisfying for all fans.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, I had never thought about this, and it's a fairly direct and simple question you ask with a complicated answer. All of these avenues for complicated programs, and I think on the whole it's a good thing because it's rapid-paced, interesting characters, complex dialogue, some of it's beautiful dialogue that is so engaging for many of us that we sit, you know, for 6 hours at a time and watch it. There's a lot more television that's worthwhile, do you think?
Definitely. And I think that the first thing to note is there's a lot more television, period. When, you know, if you go back 20 years or so, there were just far fewer channels. And a lot of the channels that now program original drama and comedy, like FX or AMC, didn't at the time. It was just mostly reruns or movies or the like. So one of the reasons we're seeing this rise is just there are many more places where television storytellers can find an avenue to share their narratives.
Mm-hmm. And how much of that is due to places like Netflix, places that you can order something in the mail or you can pay a fee and get this on your computer?
Yeah, certainly there are a wider range of ways that you can access television. Again, if we go back about 20 years or so, if you want to watch television, you had to either have an over-the-air antenna or more likely cable or satellite. And now we have the phenomenon of cord cutters who don't have cable but have an internet hookup and will watch via Hulu or Netflix or Amazon or these other avenues. Not to mention just YouTube and other sort of free online services where you can get a lot of content as well. So definitely different distribution platforms is one of the main reasons why there's such a proliferation of avenues and channels for storytellers and for viewers to consume not only different types of programming, but consume them the way that they want to consume them, on their schedule, in their timeline, not necessarily beholden to the network broadcast model.
Mm-hmm. How many are there right now? How many programs, not similar to, because certainly programs like House of Cards are unique in their popularity, but how many are we talking about? 100? A couple hundred?
You know, I don't know a firm number. I saw something a few months ago, and this is just a number that sticks in my head, around 340 scripted programs. Yeah,
oh,
and
there
were we're just talking about scripted. So obviously reality television is also booming far more than it was 10, 20 years ago. So it's really just this massive proliferation where you look at all the original programs that are being produced for Netflix and Amazon and YouTube and Vimeo, et cetera. Those are all brand new to the market. And then on top of that, all these other cable channels that may have a long history, but not as sites for original scripted programming.
Mm-hmm. So how are all of those sites, and obviously there will be different answers for the different ways they're distributed, how are those people who are making those shows and giving them to us making money? Because that has to be their primary concern, right?
Right. Yes, this is America, and
right,
that's the goal. One of the really interesting things that's happened is if you go back to the classic network era of television, which people, you know, usually point to from the 50s through the 70s and 80s. And in that era, there were pretty much three broadcast networks. And if you had a program, that was the place that you could air them. But if you're thinking about as a viewer, most of us, when we turned on the television, really we were talking about choosing between three main commercial national networks and then PBS and then some local stations.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So at most, if you lived in a big city, the most choice you would have is 8, maybe 9 or 10 channels. With the rise of cable in the 80s and really its broad spread in the 90s, that proliferates. But still, most cable channels are not really creating original programming at the level that networks are. HBO starts entering into original programming, original scripted programming in the 90s, but most cable channels are not really active in original programming until the 2000s. So you still have networks able to survive on advertising revenue up through the 90s. What's happened since then is that this average size of an audience share has decreased rapidly, so that what was considered a total flop in the 80s would be a top 20 show today.
Interesting.
Oh, just because of that, you can get by with a much smaller audience, which means a more niche show, a show with less broad appeal, but rather something that speaks to a smaller number of people, especially if those people get very intensely engaged and involved. Advertisers like that because that feels like it's a sticky program,
mm-hmm,
and people will remember what they're seeing.
And you mentioned that that's another dynamic at work here, is that people go to online spots to talk about what it is they've seen or predict what's going to happen or to clarify what has happened.
Exactly. So the idea that fans would be actively involved in a show is not new. I mean, if you talk to anyone who was fans with the original run of Star Trek or Doctor Who in the 1960s, these are passionate, engaged fan bases. The difference is that it's a lot more accessible, visible, and global today. So pretty much any TV show that you may like has at least one, if not dozens, of fan sites where fans gather and discuss that week's entry. And one of the really interesting things that I think has led to the rise of what I call complex narrative is fans engaging collectively on sites, especially using platforms like wikis and discussion forums, to analyze a show. And I call that forensic fandom. They treat a show as an object to explore, study, unpack, and in some cases a puzzle to be solved.
Isn't that amazing? We're doing it with TV shows now.
Yep.
It's just remarkable. It's like we're in an English class.
Mm-hmm. And certainly, I mean, that's what, you know, I'm a professor of media studies, and this is a lot of what we do, is try to analyze how television works as storytelling, as a site of culture. And I think that we have a generation of viewers who have taken film classes in college and have that propensity to understand, well, this, you know, this medium can be sophisticated and we can analyze it like a text we would analyze in a classroom.
Mm-hmm. Was there one particular show that got it all rolling, Jason?
No. I mean, there are a lot of different increments along the way. I mean, so you can point to some really important innovators of the 1990s. The first one that people often point to is Twin Peaks, which is in the news today because there was, you know, potentially going to be a 25-year sort of comeback of Twin Peaks on Showtime. Actually, just yesterday, it's in flux whether that's going to happen or not. But Twin Peaks was a show on ABC that debuted in 1990 and was hugely notable at the time. It had a big viewership at first and then dwindled very quickly when it got very weird. And it was always weird, but I think the weirdness sort of went beyond what viewers were interested in. And I think a show like Twin Peaks today, the amount of viewership that it sustained would still consider it a big hit today. So Twin Peaks was one important innovator. Another important innovator that was more successful long-term was Seinfeld. So, you know, Seinfeld in the 90s showed, I think, two really important lessons for television storytelling. First, you could have characters that were not likable, which has a huge influence on a lot of comedy and drama today, the whole rise of the anti-hero.
Mm-hmm.
And second, Seinfeld crafted its stories to unravel in a way that the classic Seinfeld episode, you have four main characters, each character has their own individual storyline, and the end of the episode is the four storylines colliding in unexpected ways.
Hmm.
And the effect that I've analyzed is that viewers watch the story not just to see what happened, but to analyze and predict how the story will be told. So we're watching the balls in motion. It's kind of a Rube Goldberg-style machine where we watch not just to see what will happen, but also to see how it will happen. And I think that has led to a real challenge for storytellers to figure out how can we engage viewers who are more savvy and more attuned to the mechanics of storytelling.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the variety of subjects that are dealt with, you mentioned Twin Peaks, which I never saw, and how it got kind of weird. It strikes me that some of these shows are... a lot of the shows are very political these days, which, well, let's start with that, which I find very interesting. The West Wing, that whole series, which I thought was superbly done. House of mm-hmm. Cards, also very well done. There are several shows that Madam Secretary started this year. Mm-hmm. Just
Homeland
lots of
on Showtime.
Homeland, definitely. That's yep. one that I have watched faithfully, and there's too long. I wish it was going all year because I have to pick up again next fall. I said, oh my gosh, what? I got to remember this. But are there a significant number of political shows? And if so, why?
Well, I think that, you know, traditionally before The West Wing, there was a sense within broadcasters that politics was something people did not want to watch for entertainment. They had their news divisions and their documentary shows, and then they had their entertainment divisions. And political programming was seen as commercial death. And The West Wing changed that. It's interesting. It was a fairly big hit, but what was most important was at the time, NBC that aired the show proudly proclaimed that The West Wing was the most popular show amongst people who don't watch television. So if you think about it, for advertisers, this is a huge
right.
audience that's
right.
really hard to reach. And, you know, the place where there was the biggest overlap with media consumption was NPR listeners. So West Wing spoke to people who listen to NPR but don't watch much television, especially fictional television. So advertisers really embrace that audience. So for a lot of these programs, and I think Homeland, you know, on Showtime is premium model, so it's not based on ratings, and House of Cards on Netflix. Netflix's viewer metrics are completely confidential. We have no idea how many people watch House
oh,
of Cards.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Netflix will not say. They don't sell advertising, and they believe that that secret is their competitive advantage. Personally, I think it's a lot lower than people think because I think that Netflix has their business model is predicated on people subscribing to the service, and if they create this the sense that everyone is watching House of Cards or Orange is the New Black, then you feel obligated, the fear of missing out. Oh, I have to get Netflix so I can catch up on this show. Whereas if you actually looked at the numbers and you saw, well, actually, it's only a couple million people, it's not a huge audience, then I think that there would be less motivation. Oh, I need to be in the loop. But I think the rise of political programming, like you mentioned, is because it appeals to audiences that are valuable to advertisers. More educated, generally higher economic class, tend to be more urban. And these are advertisers want to reach these audiences over some other niches, for instance.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls and hear his how you reach our conversation. Our guest has done a major study and written a book about complex TV, the poetics of contemporary television storytelling, why it is that we have so many TV shows now that are serialized that use techniques of storytelling that we understand used to be under the auspices of books and great literature, but we're seeing it now in some really remarkable television that makes us think and that uses certain kinds of techniques to draw us in, and it keeps us on our toes, keeps our mind working to understand what's going on. Why all of a sudden, instead of what we used to call this vast wasteland, we're seeing works that are, if they're not works of art, they're very interesting and they're worthy of our attention because they're complicated and they're good. And you may be involved in some of those and want to talk about some of what you've been watching or how you go about watching this. I do want to ask Professor Mattel why it is that we tend to, there's something about the way they're written that you can't stop with one. I would like to be able to do that. KP does that once a week, or he just rations himself. I can't do that anymore. I just want to sort of, okay, let's watch another one. Oh, I'll watch another one. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I said, what am I doing? I have to stop doing this. I'm sure I'm not alone in this regard, but why are we compelled to watch these one after another, too? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. We have a number of comments on our Facebook page already, so we'll bring those to the forefront and to your calls as well. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we welcome phone calls for our guest, who is the author of Complex TV, The Poetics of Contemporary Television Storytelling, and he is Professor Jason Mattel. He's a professor of film and media culture and American studies at Middlebury College. Let's go to our first caller, John in Green Bay. Hi, John.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment that I really enjoy the show, and TV shows I really enjoy, and I found it on Netflix, and now it's really popular, is Sherlock, the BBC version. I think it's just the way that they put it together and the way that it's they portray the Sherlock series. I think it's just a great show, and if you haven't seen it, you should watch it.
I have not seen it. I'm sure you've seen it, or you know about it, Jason.
Yes, I have seen it. It is a great show, and I think one of the things that's really interesting is it's a hybrid between a TV show and a sort of a series of movies. Each episode is around 90 minutes, so it feels like a feature film. Mm. And they release three, weekly. Each year or so. So it's one of the interesting things is American television has been so bound by the network broadcast schedule of 24 episodes a year each week, with summer reruns. In the UK, it's much more flexible and has been for decades. So a show like Sherlock can have these, much longer episodes and not run every week for an entire year, but rather can, have these little segments. But it is a great show that really does embrace many of the concepts of complexity that I talk about in the book, and it really is designed, like Sherlock Holmes mysteries, you know, back in their literary form, to engage viewers to figure out how it's working and to really focus on the process and procedures, not just be swept away into a sort of fictional world.
And you find it where?
So it's on... here it airs on PBS. So it's BBC in the UK, and then it airs on PBS as part of their, I think, their Masterpiece block. But it's also available on Netflix and I think Amazon. So it's very easy to catch up on.
Okay. Pam sends this message on Facebook. The great storytellers used to make movies. Now that the movies are made according to sales and marketing targets, the great storytellers are migrating to television, and new platforms like Netflix and Amazon are redefining television itself. Are the great storytellers really migrating to television? Is that where they're going now?
I think there's definitely a good deal of truth in that television has a great appeal for people who want to tell stories. Throughout the medium's history, television has been known more as a producer's medium rather than film being a director's medium. And the way that the creative process works on television is that writers are in charge of their own shows. And if you ever talk to a screenwriter who's worked on a Hollywood film, they're lucky if they can even get on the set. Whereas on a TV show, the writer is in charge. So there's this real sense that the person guiding the storytelling, which is the job in television, is called the showrunner. They are the head writer of the show. They have a team of writers that work together, and they have a lot more creative control than writers do on films. There's certainly great films that are being made, and I wouldn't say that, you know, Hollywood, the film industry today, is just aimed at reaching demographics for box office any more than they were in the 1940s, because that is the model they've been in. But definitely the trend right now for major Hollywood film productions is to reach more of the blockbuster audience, which tends to be aimed at teenagers who are going to see movies repeatedly. And television, because it's advertising driven or tied to subscription models like HBO or Netflix, you can get you can try to target different types of audiences rather than the blockbuster film audience. So I think that we're actually seeing a more diverse catering to different types of audiences on television. And whether that be the sort of big shows on networks or the big premium channels, or really niche shows that are aimed at a very small group of people, but trying to engage them in a real passionate and targeted way.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, John, for your call. Let's go to Paul in Spooner. Hi, Paul.
Good afternoon. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Good. First of all, the cable company has priced me out of the market, so everything I do is on the internet now. But I was a Twin Peaks fan. I wasn't a big Sopranos fan, but I loved Lilyhammer that came out on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm getting to the. I guess I'm one of those viewers that I would rather sit down for a weekend and watch, you know, 20 shows all weekend, and then move on to the next program. I don't have to come back every week at the same time to see what's going on television. So that was my comment.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad you brought that up. It's a whole new way of doing things, Jason.
Yeah, it is. And it actually harkens back, if we can sort of turn the clock back even further, to 19th century literary serials. So if you were a fan of Dickens in the UK, you would be, you know, you could be reading weekly, or you could wait until Great Expectations came out as a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that happened a lot in television of the 2000s with the rise of TV on DVD, so that I had a lot of friends who would wait until a season of The Sopranos or The Wire or Deadwood would come out on DVD rather than subscribe to HBO and regularly sort of watch it on a weekly basis. So you had two different types of viewing. And now with Netflix and other on-demand services, the model of the all-in-one binge is certainly growing. I still don't think it's the average way that most people watch television. I think that but it's certainly a way that a lot of people have engaged with these serials, of being able to carve out a time where they can dedicate themselves. This same way that you would read a long novel and say, I'm just going to dive in over vacation or over this weekend to consume as much as possible, rather than reading a chapter each night before you go to bed. Mm. So I think that that's the parallel that's in play. And both are very popular amongst different viewers today.
And what about which audience you're writing for? There's something about the way many of these shows, particularly shows like The House of Cards, and certainly Homeland was that way too. I would watch that in serial form and tape things so I could see it that way too. But are there some that are written so that you just can't help yourself? There's this big climax at the end and you say, oh my gosh, I just have to watch one more.
Definitely. And I think that the cliffhanger is obviously a very old and traditional storytelling device for any sort of serial text. I think that a lot of the shows that are very popular in binging use the cliffhanger as the way to get you invested to keep watching. Mm-hmm. But that was also true for broadcast. You know, an interesting example from the early 2000s was an ABC spy show called Alias. And Alias was a really fun and exciting, very stylish spy show. And when most television, they break up the story into four acts tied to commercial breaks. And with Alias, what they did was they said, we'll go ahead and break down the story into four acts. And traditionally, the fourth act will be the climax and resolution. But what they did is they moved it so the last segment that aired every week was the third act. And then the next week, they would start with the fourth act of the previous week and then start the new story.
Oh.
And that created this real engaging cliffhanger effect. Where I don't want to wait a week to watch it.
Right.
Now with the rise of seasons being released all in once, as on Netflix or Amazon, you can just go ahead and binge through and push and not suffer through the anticipation week after week.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call. Let's go next to Terry in Green Bay. Hi, Terry.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes, go right ahead, Terry.
Yes, I think it's about the development of the characters, not the climatic acts at the end of each section. I watched Breaking Bad, which I found uninteresting on television, but I spent a solid week watching it on Netflix because I could see the change, the minute changes in his character that led to this monster. And as soon as I finished that, I wanted to go back and I rewatched all of the West Wing because I could see the character develop the same way. So it's slow and steady like a great novel.
Jason?
Yeah, I'd agree 100% with that. And if you talk to almost any television writer, they say that the primary hook for audiences and for them as writers is the character. And the sense of that characterization and the relationships between characters is the really the dramatic engine of television storytelling. I think that if you think about what we're doing when we're watching a television show is we're inviting some people into our house. And oftentimes that is because these are likable characters who we enjoy spending time with. In the case of Breaking Bad, that's not true. Walter White becomes a monster, as you said, and he becomes someone who we find more and more loathsome, but fascinating in the way in which we react to him. And having that prolonged exposure to watch his moral degradation is incredibly compelling. And definitely, for me, it's one of the real triumphs of contemporary television. But I do think that for some people, it's a little bit of a matter of taste in terms of how you prefer to consume it. For some people, being able to watch it in concentrated fashion and attune themselves to those character changes is really rewarding. For other people, one of the reasons why they enjoy, and I fall in this camp myself, we enjoy serial television because it's part of a community and conversation. So one of the great advantages of weekly viewing is that I can go onto Twitter or onto blogs or onto wikis and participate in a conversation so that a whole bunch of people have all seen the same thing I have and we can talk about it. The problem with binge viewing is that it becomes far less social because no one is at the same point
right.
in
mm-hmm.
the series as I am. And in that way, it's more like reading a novel. You wait until you're finished to talk to your friends or go to the book group. Whereas with serial television or serial literature, any sort of serial narrative, the schedule dictates where you are, and you can assume everyone else is in the same place.
Thank you so much, Terry, for your call. And we do have some lines open if you want to join our conversation. We're talking about complex TV this hour, why TV storytelling has become so complex. And it would appear to be a pretty good thing, according to most of the people who have called or written us messages. Jason Mattel is our guest. He's the author of Complex TV, The Poetics of Contemporary Television Storytelling. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email, talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. A couple emails. Let me read both of them to you and then comment, please, Jason. They're short. Christina says, don't forget to mention 12 Monkeys on the Sci-Fi Channel. Can't be any more complex than time travel. And Marcia on email wondered what you think of the limited series, 8 episodes of The Slap on ABC.
Well, both of those are shows I haven't watched yet. I think that 12 Monkeys, one of the interesting things, I know the film very well. So this is another thing that has sort of risen in recent years, is adapting films or literary properties to serialized television. So 12 Monkeys is a good example of a very complex film with elaborate time travel narrative that is being expanded and really developed in new directions on television. The example that I really love of similar expansion on television is Hannibal, which is a televised version of the Hannibal Lecter story that was popular in the Thomas Harris books, like Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs, and then a series of films. But the Hannibal television show takes the mythology of this character and sort of goes before the books pick up. And it shows the way in which a multi-episode, long-form narrative can dive into characters and relationships in much richer and more nuanced ways than the films or even those novels could. As for The Slap, I haven't seen that either, but she mentions the miniseries, and I think this is another interesting development, is we've seen the rise of either, standalone series. Now, miniseries go back to, early days of television and were incredibly popular in the 70s with things like Roots.
Right.
But these miniseries are not the epic stories that yesterday's were. These are more sort of contained narratives. There's also the hybrid, like American Horror Story or Fargo or True Detective, which are series that will continue season after season, but each season it tells a new story with new characters and often in a new setting. So you can have the best of both worlds. You can have a self-contained story where you get a beginning, middle, and end over the course of a season, but you have a brand and a style of storytelling and often the same creators involved, where you can have that sense of continuity. I know what I'm going to get each season. It's going to be a new story, but I know the type of story it's going to be. I know the style, and I know that it's my type of thing.
Hmm. Randy in Sauk County, hi.
Yeah, hi. I think one of the great things about these complex series that are deep, have meaning, is that they take complex people, Monk or whoever, and they don't just villainize them. The common good about them is able to show even in their oddities, and we're all somewhat odd. And so rather than being villainized, they're able to be used, and we all can see ourselves in those people. And so it's just, I think, been a fantastic thing in society. We don't villainize the family that has a gay member, or we're coming past that now because those are the realities of our life, and it's seen as common and normal, not odd.
Jason.
Yeah, definitely. And so one of the roles of serial television is seeing relationships develop amongst characters. So even if you have a character who may be first presented as odd or villainous or at least different from the norm in a show. As it goes on, it's really to everyone's great interest to see the way that characters grow, to adapt, to recognize the humanity, to find strengths in this person. For me, one of the great shows of contemporary television is The Wire. And I think that what The Wire does is it creates humanity in very unlikely places amongst drug dealers and drug users. And it creates ambiguity in the heroes, like cops. And what it really highlights is how individuals are all, you know, are all people, but they're framed and in many ways shaped by their institutions in ways that speak to social problems. Mm-hmm. So I think we can see the sort of the complexity of an individual character as well as a constellation of characters and relationships.
Mm-hmm. Here's one that I think I've only seen one episode of, so I'm going to take this Facebook comment and throw it your way to see if I should go on with this. And I guess it's in its last season. Steve writes, a friend asked me this afternoon whether Mad Men was worth watching. I told her it was like Dallas, but the characters are more complex. Also that most of the characters were like JR, but that's another topic. Is Mad Men worth watching, Jason?
I'm an outlier in this regard. I would say that if you ask almost anyone who's a fan of the types of programs that we've been discussing, they would say definitely. Mad Men is one of the great contemporary dramatic series. I personally do not like it. I watched the first season and found it not particularly interesting and somewhat distasteful in
really
what it represented. That being said, and I don't think it was because it was you know, I saw something that no one else did. I just didn't see what everyone else found so compelling about it. Mm-hmm. The characters are, for the most part, very, if not detestable, at least exhibit degrees of sort of casual sexism and racism in ways, you know, that maybe were fitting to its era of the 60s, but I don't find particularly enjoyable to watch. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of people, Mad Men is one of the great shows because it creates an illusion of an era. It challenges some of the our assumptions about what the 60s were and what our sort of parents and grandparents' generations were like. And it's also definitely one of the most visually stylistic and compelling visual programs on television in terms of its period setting and its use of really beautiful camera work.
Right.
So not my cup of tea, but I think that a lot of people find it one of the best.
Randy, thanks for the call. Frederick in Appleton, hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for it.
Sure.
Long-time listener. My question was, although I'm not sure about what happens to Agent Bristow in Alias, it's kind of passive, and I was wondering, Professor, if the you have done any research or seen any reactions to, like, storylines in video games or different types of medium where you actually need to take an active role in the protagonist's story. And, you know, and are you more than kind of invested and involved?
Yeah, this is a really interesting area. You know, video games, not all games by any means, but many video games have become more and more sophisticated in their storytelling and characterization. And yes, there is a distinct difference when you have an avatar and that character is sort of a stand-in for you in the action. And I think a lot of people can point to games in which the moral decision-making and the consequences of your own actions have a really profound effect upon you. You know, one of the questions I think that's still at play is, can you make sort of video games in which it conveys a kind of moral attitude or perspective on the world and sort of make a statement the way that I think, you know, great drama often aims to do, but still also create a sense of agency and interactivity where your choices matter? Because if you're trying to have everything play out in a certain way where you make a statement, then basically your choices don't really matter if that's the place you're going. So it's a really complicated and I think fascinating area. It's not my primary research area, but I think that a lot of storytellers see gaming and this type of interactivity as an important horizon that will become more and more central.
More phone calls. We've been real busy here, but there's a line open right now, 800-486-8655. We're talking about complex television this year, and our guest has said could be there about 340 such programs, and they tend to be, many of them, worth watching. Something different for us are people who really have the gift of writing gravitating to this kind of television, and it's the subject of his book, Complex TV, The Poetics of Contemporary Television Storytelling. Professor Jason Mattel is with us. He's a graduate of UW-Madison and is a professor of film and media culture and American studies at Middlebury College. We'll take more phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Oops, I lost my papers. Here we go. Let's go back to phone calls and Boyd in Wautoma. Hi, Boyd.
Hi, Kathleen. Hello to your guest. I'll try and make this brief. The one thing I've noticed with a lot of recent shows, and I think they've been very good what's come out, I've noticed a lot of a rise in historical shows. You could throw, I personally think, Mad Men into that and shows like Downton Abbey and Mr. Selfridge, but you still see shows like The Vikings and The Tudors. And I just started watching the very first episode today of Turn, that takes place during the Revolutionary period, which so far so good. And then the other thing I've noticed is superhero shows, but they're much more complex in their writing. And of course, for me, a personal favorite is Gotham, which is the retelling of the Batman story. But I also think Arrow is in that vein as well. It's basically Batman without Batman. And your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's, I mean, certainly I think both of these are trends, and the logic of television from, you know, from its inception is a cycle that, TV scholars refer to as innovation, imitation, saturation. So I think that whenever you have any innovative show, so if you're talking about sort of American period dramas, Mad Men could be seen as the big innovator, or even before that, maybe something like Deadwood, which is a Western serial. You get a lot of shows that try to imitate that formula, and some of them are very successful and some of them are not. But that is a tendency that we often see. I think for historical shows, one of the big advantages of this heavy serialization is that it can play off the audience's historical knowledge of what's coming up. So one of the great appeals of Mad Men is knowing what historical markers are going to be happening in the timeline of the show, and then imagining how will our characters, these fictional characters, react to real-world events, like the assassination of JFK was a big one in that show's run. And the same thing certainly true of something like Turn about the Revolutionary War. If you know the basic history, you know that there are some big things that are coming up. A really interesting one that's one of my favorite shows on right now is The Americans, which is set in the early 1980s about Russian spies living undercover in the U.S. And you are, you know, in the first season, and there's this very dramatic moment when President Reagan is shot. And but the reaction is not about sort of America, but rather how would Russians react to this? It's a very fascinating show. And in terms of the superhero shows, I think the same, you know, is true with Hollywood, is that if you look, I mean, the most successful franchise right now in Hollywood is the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is actually quite serialized. And the interlocking film stories of, you know, Iron Man and Captain America and the Avengers, all these films require audiences to pay attention to the intersections and the way that these characters and the villains sort of intersect across these narratives. And we're seeing that play out on television as well. So these, you know, comic books have always had, you know, to greater or lesser degrees, a lot of complexity in spanning different titles and crossover characters. And I think we're seeing that on television as the comic book audience has really flocked to some of these shows.
I'm glad you mentioned The Americans, because I watched that. I don't know how many years it was. I agree that it was well done, and And very interesting. I kind of like those spy shows, historical times, too. But the first episode of this year, I found so gratuitously violent that I said to the TV, that's it. How can you, why did you do this? I don't like violence anyhow. I have to close my eyes. But this one, and then I would, you know, have to go to bed after watching the show, and it would give me nightmares. Yep. So did it get better so I can keep watching it? I'm asking you. Or should I just not watch it anymore?
Well, I would say this season is very, very good. So,
okay.
I would say, but you know, this is one of the challenges is that we are living in a time of plenty. So, you can always break up with a show and find another show that you find equally compelling in different ways. So it's you know, I always tell people if. You know, when people will ask, well, what shows are you watching? What should I watch? And I'll tell them what I'm interested in, but I'll say, look, your taste may be different, and there may be another show that is much more compelling to you. If you don't like the violence, maybe, you know, that's not the show for you.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Boyd, for your call. And let's go next to Roger in Sturgeon Bay. Hello, Roger.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
So, actually, I'm from Canada originally. But, you know, thanks to, like, Netflix and the Internet, we've really seen our shows like Trailer Park Boys go really international. And I, without the Internet, I don't think it would have been possible. And, you know, the Internet is just changing the whole thing so much. You know, I start watching the Trailer Park Boys on YouTube, and then there's the whole, like, suggestion box of other shows and even, like, these Internet shows. There's these guys out of California. They do this skit comedy called Joy Camp, and it's really interesting. It's all, like, different. They make fun of the different, like, topical issues of the time and, you know, talking about the politicians and things like the Bilderberg and that whole New World Order and those Illuminatis and all that. And it's just, it's funny because they take these real serious issues and then they make it into a funny, you know, ha-ha, kind of thing, but it's also informing the people of, like, the, you know, huge corporate agenda, but in a laughing sort of kind of way.
Jason.
Yeah, I think that one of the caller touches on two key things. I mean, first is that the Internet allows not just new consumption practices, so people can, you know, join in conversations and tweet about shows, etc., but it also lets people become producers. So we've seen not just the rise of different ways of consuming television, but a lot of different people have gotten involved in creating what we might call independent television. So you can see web series, and web series have become huge, hugely popular amongst especially teenage audiences, and very innovative in terms of the way in which they tell stories and the types of subject matter that they can tackle. So I think that that's a really important innovation as well that's kind of happening outside the dominant TV industry. The other thing the caller mentioned is so the globalization. You know, if you're in Canada, you can watch U.S. shows, and you can also see Canadian shows distributed around the world. So many of the programs that have become really huge here in the U.S. have massive followings around the world, but also the programs from other countries are starting to either be shown in the U.S., especially from the U.K. Sherlock is one example that was mentioned, but also be adapted. So Homeland is actually adapted from an Israeli drama. And The Killing, which ran for 3 seasons, was adapted from a very, very successful Danish program. Jane the Virgin, which is a new show on CW, which I highly recommend, was adapted from a Latin American telenovela. So you can really see this global exchange really playing up because the market really allows for this saturation around the world, and it becomes an untapped audience. Mm. So, and I think it leads to some innovative types of programming that people wouldn't have thought of otherwise.
Mm-hmm. One more call. Jane in Two Rivers. Hi.
Hi. Trying to be quick here. I'm mentioning two shows in particular that I thought suffered from the serialization, and that was Lost and How I Met Your Mother. They both played around with storytelling formats. The serialization was good up to a point, but they couldn't stick the landing. I think that with a serialized drama, if the ending fails, that sort of colors your view of the whole series. And
All right, let's get a response. We're almost out of time. Jason?
Now, this is a really heated issue. I have a chapter in my book all about ends and conclusions and finales, and it's, I think that there is a sense amongst fans that if there's not a clear stick in the landing, as she said, that the whole thing falls apart. Personally, I don't think that's true, because the journey in and of itself is enjoyable, and we don't watch, you know, you typically don't read a book and then if the last page is bad, you say, well, that was a waste of time. I think that for a lot of these programs, the process of watching, especially when you watch, you know, week after week, year after year, it becomes an investment. And if the end isn't what you wanted, it can hurt. But then if you go back and rewatch, you can find other fresh pleasures in it.
Hmm. Jason, thanks so much for being with us. It really was a fun hour, and I appreciate all the advice of shows to watch, too.
Well, thanks, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Our guest, Jason Mitel. His book is Complex TV, The Poetics of Contemporary Television Storytelling. And Jason did his undergraduate and graduate work at UW-Madison. He's a professor of film and media culture and American studies at Middlebury College. Is the author of several other books. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Hope you enjoy the Badgers game tonight. They're going to win by two. I said that last time, and they won by more than two, so I figure my track record is pretty good here. Thanks for listening.